When I was working on the book of Ezekiel, it is now in another millennium, people ask you, why are you working on Ezekiel? Why would anybody work on Ezekiel? And that's a very valid question, because most of us don't know what to do with a book like this. I'm so delighted that I get to spend a week with you, with many of you. It'll be only today, much too short, but I get to spend a week talking about the man with whom I lived for 15 years. There have been few people, other than our Savior, of course, who have shaped my life and ministry like Ezekiel has. And after you've lived with him for 15 years, you come out different at the other end. You have a different theology of ministry, a different view of God, whatever. Of course, since then, I have been living with Moses. One should have done Moses first. Although in critical scholars, there are those who will say there is no influence of Deuteronomy in Ezekiel. I just had a student do his dissertation on that, and when people found out he was working on that, he said, what, really, it's going to be very short, nothing to work on. But actually, I think there's a lot of Deuteronomic influence in the book of Ezekiel. I didn't realize that when I was working on Ezekiel. I should have done Deuteronomy first, because once you've lived with Moses for a decade and a half like I had, you start to see Moses everywhere. And so it's a problem, isn't it? Or is it good to do that? And of course, as you know, Jesus was influenced by Moses a great deal, and so should we. But our task this week is the book of Ezekiel. I've kind of divided the presentations into two parts. Today we're going to look at Ezekiel topically, knowing that some of you are only here for today. I thought it would be good for us, simply to whet your appetites for the book and make you wonder, how come I've never read this before? And invite you into the book and to begin to feel what Ezekiel is doing. And then we may get to chapter 1 of the book of Ezekiel by the time we are done today, but we'll spend the rest of the week then with our MA students working our way through particular texts in the book of Ezekiel, working with different genres of material, not working serially through the book, but different genres of material so that we have a handle on how to unpack every type of text that you find in the book of Ezekiel. But let's begin with Ezekiel and his times. And of course, my subtitle here is, Do You Understand What You Are Reading? I try and reassure my students and the people in the congregations that I do read the New Testament too. There's a lot of great stuff here, but you know where that comes from. This is the Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch on the way. He's reading Isaiah. And Philip asks him, Do you know what you are reading? When we approach something like the book of Ezekiel, many of us don't have a clue what we are reading. In fact, many of us never get beyond chapter 1. It is so bizarre, so strange, such a riddle. What in the world can I possibly do with this book? So I have a couple of questions for you. Have you ever heard a sermon series on Ezekiel? Anybody here? Wow, this is a record. I have never, other than, you know, stuff I've done. Now, in my background, Ezekiel would become very important at prophecy conferences. I come out of a world of dispensationalism. And the only time you'd ever work on the book of Ezekiel was in the context of prophecy conferences and plotting out the charts for the future and all the rest of it. And of course, Gog and Magog became very important in those circles. It's the only time we would ever hear anything from Ezekiel. I taught a course on Ezekiel in Russia, 1993, which is now 20 years ago. They asked me to come and teach a course on Ezekiel. And by the time I got to chapter 38 and 39, which is Gog and Magog, I began to understand why they were so tense. Because they had always been taught, we are Gog and Magog. I grew up in a world that, you know, interpreted it that way, and I don't anymore. I hope it's all right. So we're going to begin this morning with Ezekiel, the man and his times, and then we'll look at Ezekiel, the man and his method, Ezekiel, the man and his book, and Ezekiel, the man and his message. This will probably get us to the end of the day. We have a lot of synthetic things to talk about. For many, if not most Christians, the prophet Ezekiel is too strange and his book far too complex and bizarre to get much serious attention. So the prophet remains a mystery. My own encounter with this man and his work has been like one protracted 12-year, or turned out to be 15-year, wrestling match. As I wrestled with Ezekiel, I was driven by three or four questions. First, Ezekiel, what are you saying? This is the locution. What are the words? And of course, this relates to text-critical questions, among other things. Second, Ezekiel, why do you say it like that? And I'm so grateful for the doctoral mentoring I had with my supervisor, Alan Millard, at Liverpool, who introduced me to the world of Ezekiel. In fact, what got me going on this book was the question, to what extent does that Mesopotamian world in which Ezekiel lived color the book? And I discovered that it colored the book at every level, in terms of vocabulary, conceptual concepts, imagery, whatever else. But this question, I don't think we can answer only from inner biblical evidence. Ezekiel, why do you say it like that? If we don't have a bit of access to the world of Ezekiel from outside the Bible, we won't get here. I know there are some who would argue that we don't need to look outside the biblical text to understand the biblical text. It's self-contained. But I'm not of that opinion. Third question, Ezekiel, what do you mean? You may have established what Ezekiel says, even why he says it the way, but then what is the point? And of course, in speech act theory, this is the illocution. You have the locution, the illocution, and then finally we have the perlocution. Fourth question, Ezekiel, why is your message important to me? What do you want me to get out of it? Well, it's a great delight of mine to share with you some of the results of wrestling with Ezekiel, trying to answer these questions. What I offer here this week is just the tip of the iceberg, or as we used to say on the farm in Saskatchewan, the cream off the top of the milk. We really could spend an entire year together. Let's think about that. And not exhaust the unfathomable depth of the great prophet's work. And so I want to work here under these four headings. I could have worked with simpler titles like simply The Prophet Ezekiel, The Methods of Ezekiel, The Message of Ezekiel, but this would have obscured an extremely important aspect of his ministry. So I've got The Man and His Times, The Man and His Method, The Man and His Book, The Man and His Message. Although for many readers, if the personality of Ezekiel is not totally obscured by and subsumed in his work, this man is an enigma, a riddle. The man is a riddle. This is too bad if for no other reason than that he, as much as, if not more than any other prophet, embodies his message in bold new ways. Whereas other prophets used metaphors and similes, your words were found and I did eat them. What does Ezekiel do? He eats them. So they're not just literary metaphors for him. For readers of the book and for those of us contemplating ministry in the church, here we realize that the medium is the message. More than any other prophet, more even than Jeremiah and Hosea, Ezekiel is the suffering servant, arrested and driven by the overwhelming power of God, bearing the sins of his people, experiencing their rejection and scorn, and paying a dear personal price for his ministry in the loss of his wife. Chapter 24. But like the greater messianic suffering servant of whom Isaiah would write, the Lord was pleased not only to crush him, but to allot him a portion with the great. For you see, our presence here today, discussing his life and ministry, may in fact be testimony to the faithfulness of this great proclaimer of the truth. He has his portion with the great. That's why we're talking about him. So in this first lecture, I'll try to introduce you to the personality of Ezekiel and to correlate that personality with the intense crisis of faith facing his people in exile in Babylon. I could have said languishing in exile in Babylon. But that's a little misleading because while in some senses they are languishing, in other senses they are not languishing. They're doing quite all right, thank you. So we have to be careful how we handle that concept. So let's begin with the biographical facts. Who was Ezekiel? What hard data do we have on this man? If he were writing up his curriculum vitae, what facts would he record? So let's begin with the person of Ezekiel, his name. All that we know of Ezekiel we learn from this book that bears his name. Like many Hebrew names, Yechezkel represents either an affirmation of faith, God strengthens, or God toughens, and we know how important that concept will be for him. Or it's an appeal to faith. It could be, may God strengthen. May God toughen. The name is related to names like Hezekiah, where you have Yah on the end. Yahweh has strengthened. Here you've got Yehezkel, El, at the end. This form of the name, only one other person in the Old Testament. Also a priest from an earlier generation, 1 Chronicles 24:16. Unless, of course, Ezekiel, the name, is a pseudonym attached to some otherwise anonymous prophet. And there are times when we're not quite sure whether these are names or whether they are just pseudonyms. Malachi, is that a name? My messenger. Or is it simply a title of his office? Well, I think it was actually a name. But unless it's a pseudonym attached to an otherwise anonymous prophet, based on the nature of his ministry, the name appears to express the faith of his parents at the time of his birth. But the prophet did indeed live up to his name. In the face of cynicism and rejection to his ministry, Yahweh, the Lord, did indeed strengthen. From chapter 1, verse 1, we learn something else about him. It's actually in chapter 2, on the 5th of the month, in the 5th year of King Jehoiachin's exile, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel, the priest, son of Buzi. We don't know exactly who this Buzi was. This name actually is used of three or four people. But then it's followed by the priest. Buzi the priest. Now, it's a little ambiguous. Does that refer to Ezekiel the priest? Ezekiel the son of Buzi, Ezekiel the priest. Or is it Ezekiel the son of Buzi, who is the priest? I have a sense that it applies to the latter, since Ezekiel left Jerusalem before he could have been inducted into the priesthood. I think it refers to his father. And of course, as you know, the priesthood was an inherited position, an office. So he comes out of a priestly family. Nothing is known of his maternal parentage, nor do we know where he was born or where he lived. Unlike Jeremiah, his contemporary from Anathoth, just north of Jerusalem, we don't know where he lived before he was taken to Babylon in 597 or 8. In Ezekiel's 25th year, his world came crashing down. Assuming the 30th year, you notice the beginning of the book? It happened in the 30th year on the 5th day of the month. 30th year of what? He doesn't tell us. I'm assuming for the moment that this 30th year refers to the prophet's age. He is 30 years at the time these events described in this chapter occurred, which means he will have been born in 623 BC. Oh, that should ring a bell. What's happening in 623 BC in Jerusalem? Well, this was the midpoint of Josiah's distinguished, if prematurely terminated, reign. Josiah 640 to 609 BC. Ezekiel's own name may reflect the optimism of his parents in view of the renaissance of the nation of Judah under Josiah. In fact, within a year of Ezekiel's birth, 622-21 BC, while repairmen were working on the temple, Hilkiah the high priest would discover the book of the Torah in the temple. That event would inspire the king to institute a series of far-reaching reforms, climaxing in an enthusiastic celebration of the Passover, an enthusiasm unprecedented since the pre-monarchic period. That's what the chronicler tells us. We haven't had a Passover like this since before we had kings. So that was under Josiah. Ezekiel grew up with neighbors all around talking about Josiah and probably talking about Hilkiah and Shaphan, leaders in the reform movement. He also grew up hearing his compatriots talking about the political ambitions of Josiah. You know the story. Not satisfied with purging Jerusalem and Judah of its pagan high places and cult objects, Josiah pushed his crusade for orthodoxy into the heartland of the former northern kingdom of Israel. According to 2 Kings 23, he began at Bethel, just beyond his northern border. There he demolished the altar and images of the shrine that Jeroboam had constructed as a symbol of northern apostasy and political independence in the 10th century. And at the time he set up these calves, you remember, the prophet came by and said, a king, Josiah, is going to destroy this thing, mentioned by name. Then Josiah extended his purge to the cities of Samaria, which in context means the cities of the rival kingdom. Ezekiel must have heard his parents and neighbors reflecting on the significance of these events. By extending his influence into what had been recognized for exactly one century as the province of the vast Assyrian Empire, we need to ask ourselves, who does Josiah think he is? What business has he got moving into this Assyrian province and imposing on them the reforms, the spiritual reforms? I think he thinks he is David, reborn, and he's trying to recover the boundaries of the Davidic kingdom. but the prospects for a comprehensive political and spiritual renaissance were dashed to the ground in 609 BC. In what turned out to be a foolish show of force. It's interesting to read that story in the Chronicler, where Pharaoh Necho is going up to join with the Babylonians in the last gasp against the Assyrians, or the Assyrians' last gasp. Pharaoh Necho is coming up to Megiddo with his armies, and Josiah tries to stop him. And Pharaoh Necho is the one who says, "Don't stop the plan of God." And so a random arrow is shot and it strikes and kills Josiah. He was killed attempting to intercept the Egyptian army on its way to assist the Assyrians against the emergent Babylonian forces of Nabopolassar. All of Judah's hopes died with Josiah. Within the next 11 years, three kings would succeed him. I don't know if I have these on here. I don't. We'll come back to this later. Three kings would succeed him. It was a turbulent time in Jerusalem politics. And in the meantime, everyone would be judged by the Deuteronomist as doing evil in the sight of the Lord for revitalizing the old apostate ways of Manasseh. And in the meantime, the land of Judah had become the vassal of Egypt, had fallen under the control, and then fallen under the control of Nebuchadnezzar. Fed up with the treasonous behavior of his vassals, finally, in 597 BC, Nebuchadnezzar's armies marched into Jerusalem, seized direct control to squelch any possible mutiny in the future. Nebuchadnezzar deported the royal family and 10,000 of the nation's foremost citizens, including Ezekiel. He went with him. The fact that Ezekiel was taken into exile with these 10,000 suggests that he was numbered among Judah's upper classes prior to the exile. For the first time in his life, membership in the club of the privileged didn't offer immunity from the harsh realities of life. On the contrary, it made Ezekiel a target for the Babylonians. The reason for the Babylonian interest in Ezekiel may have been his profession. As I already noted, Ezekiel was the son of Buzi the priest. Accordingly, as a 25-year-old in 597, his grooming for the high priesthood in any case, will probably have already begun. The stamp of Ezekiel's priestly heritage is found everywhere in his book. His thorough familiarity with the temple layout, his understanding of orthodox and pagan cult forms, his mastery of the spiritual heritage of Israel, specifically Levitical priestly issues, his concern for a rebuilt temple, leave the impression of one thoroughly prepared for spiritual leadership in the tradition of the priesthood. He probably was one of the few in line for that ministry who took the calling seriously. But even there, I have to be cautious, as we'll see in a moment. I'm not sure, actually, he took it seriously as a 25-year-old. He arrived in exile at the age of 25. 20 years later, he was still active in Babylon, Ezekiel 29:17. We don't know when Ezekiel died, but while in exile, he mourned the passing of his wife, who died suddenly on January 5th, 587 BC. We'll talk more about these dates later. Nothing is known about his marriage, though one may deduce from the fact that the first phase of his ministry was carried out from his home. His wife had to develop a great deal of patience with her husband. She could never predict what he would do next, and had to put up with a constant stream of company, including high officials of the exilic community, who would seek out her husband for an oracle from God, or the exilic population in general, who came simply to be entertained by his strange antics and impressive rhetoric. She had to put up with this. And yet she could never have a conversation with him, because his mouth, he was tongue-tied. He couldn't talk about the weather. He couldn't talk about what shall we have for dinner. The only time he could speak was when God opened his mouth. I mean, it must have been a frustrating marriage. Turn to chapter 33. I mean, we're going to be working our way in particular text, but this is an illuminating episode here. Ezekiel 33, verse 30. But as for you, son of man, your fellow citizens who talk about you by the walls of the doorways of the houses, they speak to one another, each to his brother, saying, come on, let's go over to Zeke's house. I hear there's another word from God. And so they come to you as people come, and they sit before you as if they were my people. But they do the lustful desires expressed by their mouths, and their heart goes after their gain. And guess what? Behold, look, see, you are to them like a sensual song. He's a crooner, one who has a beautiful voice and plays well on an instrument, for they hear your words, but they don't practice them. So when it comes to pass, as it surely will, then they will know a prophet has been in their midst. That's Ezekiel. That's what his wife had to put up with until, of course, her death as described in chapter 24. This is Ezekiel the man, trying to fill in the blanks of this character. But let's talk about his personality. No Israelite prophet has been the subject of so much psychoanalytical study as Ezekiel. He's a nut. Is that an Australian idiom? The nut of the Old Testament. While prophets were known often to act and speak erratically for rhetorical purposes, the concentration of so many bizarre features in one individual leaves Ezekiel in a class of his own. His muteness, lying bound and naked, digging holes in the wall of his house, emotional paralysis in the face of his wife's death, his spiritual travels, images of strange creatures, eyes and creeping things, hearing voices and the sounds of water, his withdrawal symptoms, fascination with feces and blood, wild literary imagination, pornographic imagery, unreal if not surreal understanding of Israel's past, and the list goes on. It's a pathological character. It's no wonder that scholars like Carl Jaspers found in Ezekiel an unequaled case for psychiatric analysis. E.C. Broom concluded that Ezekiel was a true psychotic, capable of great religious insights, but exhibiting a series of diagnostic characteristics. Catatonia, narcissistic, masochistic conflict, schizophrenic withdrawal, delusions of grandeur and persecution. In short, according to Broom, he suffered from a paranoiac condition common in many great spiritual leaders. Well, thankfully, in the past few decades, the psychoanalytical approach to this man has generally been rejected by commentators and psychiatrists alike. But not totally. About 20 years ago, I was at SBL. And of course, when you're at the Society of Biblical Literature, I mean, that's just when I was getting involved in this, and essays were coming out on the book of Ezekiel as I was working serially through them. I was at SBL, and a guy by the name of D.J. Halperin noticed my name tag. And he said, you wrote an essay in Catholic Biblical Quarterly on Ezekiel, didn't you? I did, yes. And in that one, in that essay, I argue that all the text-critical problems in chapter 1, and there are more problems per square inch in that chapter than anywhere else in the book, they are best explained on the basis of Ezekiel's emotional state at the time of his writing this. Well, I ran into him, and he introduced himself. He said, I've just come out with a book in which I've used your essay. I found it very helpful, and I discover here he has gone back to the old psychiatric interpretation of Ezekiel, or psychological, psychosomatic, and used my essay to defend that view. I'm not sure I was flattered. He said, go, you'll see my book on the book table. Brand new book at the time, Seeking Ezekiel, Text and Psychology. It's not exactly what I had in mind. But Halperin attributes the extraordinary features of Ezekiel's prophecy to an unconscious but overwhelming rage against females, whom he perceives as cruel and powerful, seductive and treacherous, and a more deeply buried rage against male figures because of some abuse experienced as a child. Halperin opines, Ezekiel was surely unique in the severity of his sickness and in the power of the images he found to express it, end of quotation. But he recognizes that this sickness arose from a general cultural pathology that affected the elders of the exiles as well. Well, that's David Halperin, 1993. While psychoanalysis of the person may explain certain features of the text, the whole enterprise, in my mind, is far too speculative about Ezekiel's past and too conjectural about his emotional state to be convincing. How do we know he was abused as a child? And what is it about Ezekiel that is this, problem with women? Well, when you get to chapter 16, you begin to understand some of these natural interpretations of these. But in my view, not only does it disregard the rhetorical function of prophecy to change the thinking and behavior of the audience, it also fails to recognize that the symptoms of authentic prophetic experiences may often resemble what uninitiated folk diagnose as a fundamental pathology. A prophet looks sick. More seriously, it turns the explicit evidence of the text on its head. Whereas the pervasive emphasis of the book is on the initiative of God in controlling the thinking and actions of the prophet, according to Halperin, Yahweh becomes a creation of Ezekiel's own brain. Well, we're not so far removed from that. A couple of years ago, I've been out of Ezekiel studies for some time as a focus, but the folks who are working on Ezekiel keep dragging me in. And at SBL, for 3 years running, they were doing a series of sessions devoted to the God Ezekiel creates. And so I got an invitation from Dalit in Tel Aviv. Would I contribute an essay to this year's sessions on the God Ezekiel creates? Well, I wrote her back and I said, that's a very intriguing topic, but when I read the book of Ezekiel, I don't find Ezekiel creating any realities. So if you insist on that topic, I probably won't do it. On the other hand, and then I offered, like Daniel and his friends when they were in Nebuchadnezzar's court, let's try other kinds of food. They had an alternative. I suggested if you're interested in a topic like the God Ezekiel wants you to meet, that I can work with. And she wrote back and said, exactly. And she, of course, by then, she knew my work. And that's actually what she expected me to do. So that was a different project. And so in the book here, By the River Kibar, we have a copy of that essay at SBL, The God Ezekiel Wants You to Meet. And it's a totally different picture than most people see. And in many people's minds, including some evangelical scholars, there is nothing redeemable about the book of Ezekiel for the church. In the book of Ezekiel, God is the problem. I don't actually find it to be that way. I find the God of Ezekiel to be an amazing God of grace and patience. Everything that you see in Exodus 34:6-7 Remember when God introduces himself to Moses? Yahweh, Yahweh, gracious, compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in chesed, mercy and truth, who forgives every kind of sin but will not leave the guilty unpunished. That's what I find in the book of Ezekiel. There's no denying the uniqueness of his ministry, but to attribute this to a pathology rising from early abuse and an Oedipus complex misconstrues the profundity of his message and the sensitivity of his personality. His prophetic experiences, symbolic actions, and oracular pronouncements derive from encounters with God that have affected his whole being. What other prophets spoke of, Ezekiel suffers. He is a man totally possessed by the Spirit of Yahweh, called, equipped, and gripped by the hand of God. Ezekiel is a mophet, a sign, a portent, carrying in his body the oracles he proclaims and redefining the adage, the medium is the message. Furthermore, he is a profound theologian, exposing the delusions of his audience and reintroducing them to the God of Israel. While recognizing the force of Ezekiel as a rhetorician, his authenticity as a spokesman for Yahweh, and his stature as a theologian, this does not mean he was naturally so. In fact, when I was writing the commentary, I was totally frustrated with the publishers. It took so long. Just about the time I submitted my manuscript, the series editor died. I took one look at it and said, this is R.K. Harrison. Passed away, and it took them 3 years to find a new series editor. It took them 3 years to get my stuff out. And actually, it's just as well, because in the meantime, I started rethinking some things about Ezekiel the man. In the first draft of that commentary, I was where most people were, and that is that Ezekiel is a willing servant. He lets God use him. And, you know, a year and a half later, it dawned on me that there's so much about the early chapters of Ezekiel's book that makes so much more sense if you see him as part of the problem. I think he was part of the problem initially. He is a rhetorician, yes. But when I read his prophecies, especially the early chapters of the book, the idealistic image that I had when I sent in my manuscript changed. And a year later, I wrote the publisher back and said, can I revise what I was doing? And so I rewrote the whole introductory section on chapter 1, 2, and 3, and that affected 100 pages all the way through the manuscript. I changed my mind on this guy. And of course, I remind my students all the time that anything we write is in soft lead pencil. It has to be. It has to be. We grow in our understandings. The word of the Lord stands forever. But the foolish interpretations of human beings are always subject to revision as we work together as a community of faith, wrestling with the Scriptures, the Word of God. But all of a sudden, as I was rereading these early chapters, having written the commentary, it dawned on me that this idealistic image of the prophet wasn't quite satisfying. And I've a dozen questions that were raised about Ezekiel the man. Why is the theophany, the theophanic prelude to his commission, so utterly overwhelming? Chapter 1, verses 40. It's overwhelming to us. We read this, and by the time I'm done reading that chapter, I'm down on my face too. I don't get it. As Ezekiel was. Why so overwhelming? 2, why does the divine spirit need to enter Ezekiel, set him on his feet before he will listen to the voice of the Lord after he has commanded him to stand up? 2:1-2. 3, why does Yahweh warn him, don't be rebellious like the rest of your people? 2:8. 4. Why does Yahweh need to command Ezekiel 3 times, eat the scroll, eat the scroll, eat the scroll, and in the end, the Lord stuffs the scroll into his mouth? 5. Why does Yahweh deliver 2, in many respects, redundant commissioning speeches? Speech A, 2, 3 to 7, and speech B, 3, 4 to 11. You put these side by side, and it's a ditto. If my students did this, I'd say, rewrite. You're padding, you're repeating yourself. 6. Why does the prophet emerge from the commissioning embittered in the rage of his spirit? Mar Bahamat Ruhi, chapter 3:14, which necessitates the strong hand of God on him. 7. When he returns to the exiles, why does he sit among them for 7 days in a state of shock, emotional desolation? 8. When the Lord finally breaks the silence, why does he deliver such a stern warning to Ezekiel against noncompliance with a prophetic charge? This is the watchman text. Son of man, I've made you a watchman. Have you read that passage lately? That is not for the people's consumption, that one. That's for Ezekiel's consumption. Ezekiel, you're the watchman. And if you don't do as I tell you, guess what? Their blood is on your hands. 9. Why are such severe restrictions placed upon the prophet's movements? He is to shut himself up in his house. Others will bind him. The Lord will tie his tongue. 3:24 to 27. Could it be that if he was left to do his own thing, he would be changing everything about the divine mission? 10. Why was the prophet explicitly forbidden to defend or mediate for his people? 3:27. 11. Why do the Spirit and the hand of the Lord play such a dominant role at the time of his call and throughout his ministry? I mean, there's none of the prophets who is so controlled by the hand of God. My roots are Mennonite, and Mennonites are not known for their Calvinism. The opposite extreme, actually. But I was teaching a course on the book of Ezekiel at Bethel Seminary, and my older brother, who was working on a Doctor of Ministry degree, came to take this course for me. And of course, we grew up in the Mennonite world. I haven't been there for a while. We've moved around too much. But my brother was still involved in the men. And he says, Dan, you're such a Calvinist. Well, while I have problems with the labels, if you're Anabaptist, I mean, you have a problem with the labels. When I'm reading Ezekiel, I have to sound like a Calvinist. This is the man whose world is controlled by a sovereign God. Why this emphasis? The Spirit coming upon him, picking up and carrying him away. The hand of the Lord grabbing him by his hair. Whatever else. All of this is... And I asked myself, why all this in the book of Ezekiel? What is it about the man? These questions are not easily answered unless one recognizes a problem in the prophet. It should probably not surprise us if Ezekiel was tempted to rebel against his prophetic calling. With the exception of his contemporary Jeremiah, who was also of priestly background, and who also protested his call. Remember Jeremiah? Where the Lord says, before you were born, I knew you, I picked you. Jeremiah says, that's not fair. You didn't give me a chance to negotiate the terms of this commission. Jeremiah protested. I have a feeling Ezekiel was protesting too. With the exception of Jeremiah, who was also priestly. As the twilight of Judah approached, the priests as a class seemed to have been more a part of the problem that precipitated the night than the solution the Lord had prescribed. Although the priests do not figure much in Ezekiel's preaching, in 22:26 he specifically indicts his professional peers because they, quote, have done violence to Yahweh's instruction, they have desecrated what is sacred to him, they failed to distinguish between the holy and the profane, and they failed to teach the difference between clean and unclean, they've closed their eyes to the Sabbath. As a result, Yahweh is profaned in their midst. This is Ezekiel's problem, and we should actually, in chapter 2, Son of Man, verse 3, I am sending you to the sons of Israel, to the rebellious people who have rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed me. I am sending you to them who are stubborn and obstinate children, and you shall say to them, thus says the Lord God, as for them, whether they listen or not, for they are rebellious house, they will know a prophet has been in their midst. And you, son of man, neither fear them nor fear their words, though thistles and thorns are with you and you sit on scorpions. Neither fear their words nor be dismayed at their presence, for they are a rebellious house. But you shall speak my words to them, whether they are listen or not, for they are rebellious. Now you, son of man, listen to what I am speaking to you. Do not be rebellious like that rebellious house. You ever felt that way? When the call of God comes to you, and you can't help yourself. Isaiah says, I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. We got a problem here. Isaiah recognized the problem. I'm not sure Ezekiel even recognized the problem. I think he's part of it at this point. Well, one should not, therefore not be surprised if Ezekiel, a member of the priestly class, 1:3, was infected with some of the same spiritual malady that plagued the group as a whole. Scholars regularly point to Jeremiah as a classic resistor to the call to prophetic ministry, or even Moses. And in this respect, I'm wondering if Ezekiel isn't a second Moses. You remember, Moses has these five excuses. Ezekiel doesn't verbalize his excuses, but there's something going on here. It seems to me that Ezekiel was even more intransigent in the face of his divine call than Jeremiah. And if in the end, the nation turned around spiritually in the wake of Ezekiel's preaching, something seems to have happened. I asked the MA students to read the whole book of Ezekiel out loud before we gather. I hope you did. The scriptures were made to be read out loud. No, they were not made to be read out loud by us. They were made to be heard by us. The scriptures were written to be read by God's ministers in the hearing of the community. When I read the book of Ezekiel aloud, I ask myself, what in the world would Ezekiel have, how would he have responded to his own message? Some of us are already in the ministry and we're called to preach the word, but we're sometimes shocked to discover that the scriptures weren't written primarily to be preached. They were written to be heard. This is the sermon. And as I read Ezekiel's preaching and let his preaching dig deep into my soul, I ask myself, Ezekiel, who's talking here? How did you get here? The interesting thing is, there isn't a hint in the book of Ezekiel of anybody responding positively to his message. This is where he's different from Jeremiah. Jeremiah has a couple of buddies, doesn't he? He's got Baruch. And, you know, there's Shaphan and, you know, a couple in that clan. As far as we know, Ezekiel has nobody. He is all by himself in that world called into the ministry. Oh, they come to him for entertainment, but They don't care about the message. They want a show. And he gives them a good show every time. He never disappoints. The interesting thing is, while there isn't a hint of any positive response in the book, not one, guess what happened? 538. Remember what happened 538? Or 539? Cyrus' decree. Go home and rebuild the temple. Rebuild the community of faith. What happened? How many went home? Ezra gives us some numbers, doesn't he? What is it? 54,000? Here we go. According to their ability, okay, that's the numbers. The whole assembly numbered 42,360 besides the male and female servants, who numbered 7,000, and they had 200 singing men and women. Where did these people come from? In 597, Ezekiel and his compatriots were dragged into an exile, a hopelessly hardened lot. In 539, 43,000, you add the numbers, exactly 50,000 people from Babylon went home in faith. Where'd they come from? My theory is, when these events happen, and they surely will, they will know that a prophet has been in their midst. And I think it dawned on them. Yes, the Lord's message is true. And out of that whole troop, we do have all of these converts to true and orthodox faith. So that in the end, we don't know how Ezekiel's life ended, but in the end, he could have taken some comfort in knowing that, yes, there was fruit for his labor. But we'll come back to that when we talk about the call of Ezekiel and the implications that has for our own understandings of the call.